American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And now, for Newsreel, here's Sean Kennedy.
Good day. This is Sean Kennedy reporting to you from the Internet for Wednesday, January 19th, 2005. And if you can't already tell, my body is completely trashed. This is weird. I've got, like, the weird case of Tuesday sickness. Last two Tuesdays in a row, I felt like just hammered snob, which is not so good. But, you know, we do what we can in order to fight the good fight. And like you tuning in to listen, I will be, I will put out the show. Does that make sense? Is that good? No. No, I don't think it is. I don't think that's a good one. I tried to make a nice little colloquialism out of that. You're going to have to also forgive me because I'm on a whole bunch of prescription meds. No, I'm not on prescription meds either. I'm on, I'm not even on cough syrup. But anyway, I have the flu and my head's a little fuzzy. So we're going to get through this news show as best we can. And hopefully you guys will be fairly merciful with me when you check on my fact-finding missions and all the rest of it. Moving right into feedback. I have a quick question. How many Wogs are there in the world? Or how many do you all estimate there being? Thanks, Faithful Wog, Grant. Well, Grant, I would say that, realistically, I would say that 10% of the world's population is probably Wog. That's if you take into account the raw numbers of society. You know, if you were to just take a look at straight-up numbers, who's all there, I'd say probably 10%. Because you've got to look... Most of your WOG crowd are usually the people ostracized first. These are the people who've been pushed by the wayside. These are people who've been stepped on a little bit. These are people who've been kicked around a little bit. And because of this, they become more aware. There's a Buddhist slogan that suffering begets wisdom. And the wisdom that's gained from being ostracized by society is you quickly begin to realize that you are nothing more than your reputation really is nothing more than the sum total of other people's views. So, realistically, if you care about your reputation, then you care very much about what other people think about you, and then there again, you are controlled by the people. So, this is something that I think it was Voltaire originally said, that if to care what other people think is to be controlled by them. And it rings true. It rings true. So, I would say that with the WOG Nation, you have to look at all the people who are knocked out of the social timing, and then you've got to look at of that populace how many are online, and of those populace that are online, how many of them have the conviction and the depth of faith and the kind of intellect required to realize that Where we're going. It takes a lot of courage to be a WOG. It takes a lot of courage to stand up and say, you know what, I think everything's kind of screwed up. It takes a lot of courage to do that. So to answer your question, I would say about 10% of the population of the planet is probably WOG. Now, moving right along. Dear Sean, you made some comments on the topics of defeating lie detectors. Another good strategy is to be highly stressed out throughout the entire session, if that's possible. This will stop them from being able to distinguish anything from their readings. Now, this is true, too. I've heard of that as well, if you go stressed out. Some people say if you take a bit of speed before you go in there, or if you smoke a joint before you go in there, sometimes that'll, throw their settings way off. Of course, chances are if you're taking a lie detector test, they're going to be watching what you're doing for, up to 12 hours prior to that. So, if you can stress yourself out, that's another good way of doing it. Very, very good point. Very, very good point. Number three, dear Sean, a while back I found a diagram of how to build an RFID, those radio frequency identification tags, a jammer for these things that fits inside your pocket and was totally legal. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to find it as this letter, but they do exist. I remember correctly, the range can be boosted with a battery, so if you were to park in front of one of these core political whore marts with just enough juice that you could, in theory, jam their whole store. Not that I'm encouraging that. After all, It's frequency generating another frequency and bouncing it back to the store. Thus, you can flood out the frequency or cancel it out altogether. Hmm, that's interesting. As a point of interest, to anyone out there that might want to design an RFID jammer, the ISO standard of the 15693 says that they work on the 13.56 megahertz for the smaller ones and 915 megahertz for the long-range ones. And that's from Lizard. What a great idea. You know, nobody wants this RFID. We told them not to have the RFID. And wouldn't it just be tragic if a bunch of people started jamming the RFID? Because realistically, you could totally do that. That's a completely doable thing. And it's so incredibly slick. It's brilliant. And if you can make one small, if anyone has access to plans on how to do that, maybe that's something we should be something I'll look at for patrolling. Sounds like it could be an option. Dear Sean, according to a posting on Cyberpunk List, the commercial software being used to replace Carnivore is AGG Group's Skyline. Ah, remember yesterday we were talking about Carnivore? Carnivore was the FBI snooping program, which I talked about yesterday being killed. And now to replace that, they're going with a civilian piece of software. And of course, you know, server provides. I got an email here from PigMonkey saying that AGG Groups, but that's all like one word, like AGGROUPS. A group's Skyline. I've never heard of it, and so I'd be interested if any of your listeners could get some info on that. That's from PigMonkey. So if anyone is familiar with this piece of software, this is exactly it. You know, we read about that. We heard that somebody else did it. We get some feedback now. Let's see how we can learn about what they're using here. I'd like to know what that program's all about. Moving into Sort Yourself Out. Dear Sean, I weigh about 260 pounds now. I used to weigh 260 pounds. And I wanna lose some weight so that I can be healthy size. I know you lost a bunch of weight, and I was kind of curious about how much you lost, and over how long, and how you went about it. That's from EJ. Well, you know, I'm always on about diet. You know, the problem is with diet is that we become victims of convenience. You know, we think that just going and grabbing whatever is convenient, we become used to that. That's why fast food is fast food. You know, you just drive in, grab it, and go. Now, everybody wants to eat healthy, but the problem is actually, you know, finding the time to do meal planning and set everything up. And it's difficult to find a healthy, feel expedient way to stuff your face. It's hard. But the best thing I can recommend is to exercise in the morning. When I say exercise, a lot of people think that exercise has to be crappy. I walked my weight off. I'm lucky enough to live by a really large park in British Columbia, which is beautiful. So I used to take my dog, and I'd walk, and just walk, and walk, and walk, and walk, and walk, and I'd do like 5-6 miles, and, you know, try not to eat nothing but jujubes, you know what I mean? Like, just try to eat some healthy food. Don't, you know, kill yourself with chocolate and ice cream every day. And work out in the mornings before you eat, because apparently that's like 500% more effective if you work out in the morning. So if you run, the way I used to do this is if I'd run 3 kilometers in the morning, if I did it before I ate, the way my rationale would be, that'd be like running 15 kilometers if I ate breakfast first, which is great. You know, I mean, wow. Because that's a little motivating. So it gets you up, and then you've got this one moment. And it's good if you go for like a quick run or a quick walk, even if it's just around the block, even if it's just, you know, burning some exercise the minute you wake up, because you start the day with a win. It's nice to start the day with a victory. And quite often, you know, like, life is pretty hard these days, and, you know, sometimes you don't get a win for the rest of the day, so it's nice to get a workout in the morning. Stretching is also vital. Drinking lots of water, which sounds funny, but it's very important to lose weight. It's a lifestyle choice. You know, if you're 260 pounds, you're 260 pounds because you're not doing anything, and your input is exceeding your output, you know what I mean? That's what's going on here. So you have to either increase your output or decrease your input. This is all there is to it. Now, if you do both, if you decrease your input, which you got to be careful with, because that's when you get into fad diets and stuff like that. I don't believe in magic bullets. I think that you know, the Master Cleanser fast that I do is very healthy, but that's not really a method to lose weight. That's a detox thing. Yes, you do drop weight pretty huge with the Master Cleanser system. But I wouldn't recommend the people fasting just to lose weight. I mean, it's always good to do a detox. And anyone who wants more information on that, you can check it out on Patrolling with Sean Kennedy. Or you can do a search for Stanley S. Burroughs, not William S. Burroughs, Stanley S. Burroughs Master Cleanser. And it's a great fasting system to kind of purify the body, detox yourself, that kind of a thing. Number six, my opinion. Dear Sean, you flip-flop a lot. Oh, here we go. First, you talk about nuking the Middle East. Then you want peace. First, you want the Marines to take charge. Then you want to bring them home. What's your stance on the Middle East and the Holy Land? Well, that's easy. That's easy. You got to bear in mind the war that we're facing right now, the actual war that we are fighting, is, yes, it's a war over oil, but the actual war itself, the conflict that we're having and how this conflict is going to just keep on going and going for generations, is it's a cultural war. We are having a cultural war. The Middle Eastern cultures are very, very different from North American cultures, especially in, you know, the Holy Lands, where you've got religious police and a lot of these really kind of a little bit scary, backwards religious thinking. Now, the problem is that I believe people should be free, but, you know, some of these religions, like Christianity, like some of the other ones, they can't, Judaism and all that stuff. I mean, everyone's chasing each other around, talking about holy rocks and holy lands and wailing walls and all sorts of crap. And it's a very passionate issue, and these people have a lot of themselves tied up in these, you know, completely mythical problems of, you know, religion. So, my stance on the Middle East is, and what to do with the Holy Land and all that is to, well, all land is holy. It doesn't matter if it's here or there, for one, but never mind that. I think that it's an education issue. And we need to educate the people of the Middle East and let them know that, you know what, maybe in a couple generations, the kids will wake up and, you know, maybe get into rock and roll or do something so that they'll, you know, start to think outside of, you know, the ashram or whatever it is they do over there. I can't understand fundamentalist religious culture. I don't know what to do about it. And when you have a culture war like the kind of war we're having, people die. You know, there's no avoiding it. These people are going, their concept of reality and what's awaiting them after their death is completely different from what people in North America have. So it's a problem. It is a problem. And I don't think for a minute that I'm, you know, pro-killing, but I'm pro-killing versus, you know, letting, you know, I think a person should be able to defend themselves and defend what they have. As well, you know, there's also the argument about the war for oil in the Middle East. How screwed would we be without the oil? You know, it could be argued that maybe we should do some stuff with alternative energy and all the rest of it. But, you know, since we're not doing that, you know, it's a fair argument that maybe the powers that be are trying to keep things status quo. Maybe as the government, they are trying to make sure that everything, you know, the trains run on time and all the rest of it by having this war for oil. I mean, it's a resource. All wars are fought over resources, whether you like it or not. So, I mean, it's a point, counterpoint. But the bottom line, what do you do about the Middle East? You got to educate those people and try to get rid of the hate. That's the only thing you can do. In the news, there is a real source for some soulless music in the world. The Secret is out. The recording business is once bastion of wayward creative flair. Yeah, sure it is. The record business. No, there's no creative flair there. It's sharks. It's coming to the plain old-fashioned science of statistical analysis. The magic ingredient set to revolutionize the pop industry is a simple piece of software that can predict the chance of a track being a hit or a miss. This computerized equivalent of television programmer jukebox jury is known as Hit Song Science, HSS, and has been developed by Spanish company Polyphonic HMI, which used decades of experience to develop artificial intelligence technology for the banking and telecoms industries to create a program that analyzed underlying mathematical patterns in music. It isolated and separated 20 aspects of song construction, including melody, harmony, chord progression, beat, tempo, and pitch, and identifies and maps recurring and identifies and maps recurring patterns in songs before matching against a database containing 30 years worth of Billboard hit singles, 1.5 million tunes in all. The program then accords the song a score, which registers, in effect, the likelihood of it being a chart success. Just like that. Run it through the software. Do-do-do-do-do-do. Bing! And this will be a hit. So we'll power play this so we have machines telling us what we'll like. Now, the article goes on from there, and it talks about how, well, you know, its only downfall is that it can only recognize trends. And there's, you know, you get someone truly unique comes on the music scene, like, you know, Hendrix or the Beastie Boys back in the day or whatever, and they won't get any radio play and they won't get anything unique out there because it doesn't fit with the program. The computer says no, so unfortunately, you don't get to be the pop star this year. Thanks so much. This is how soulless the music industry has become, where they're having computers pick the hits. I mean, that's pathetic. It's really sick that the art has gone so far as to allow a piece of software to determine what the next musical hit will be. Click and shoot. Australian game hunters are logging onto a website that invites users to shoot live animals with the click of a mouse. The site, denounced as obscene by animal activists, now check this out, apparently it's legit, will offer a real-time link to U.S. Game Hunting Ranch where online shooters can kill their targets. Video cameras will be connected to rifles with sensors that can be controlled by computer users anywhere in the world. The rifle range overlooks a 145-acre reserve in San Antonio, 145-hectare reserve in San Antonio, Texas, where deer, antelope, and wild hogs roam. Paying members will be able to take aim, shoot, then ship their kill home, stuffed and mounted as a trophy. So, let me get this straight. I log in, pay some money, and I get to kill something that you send it to me. Didn't I do this in Afternow? The site will even record footage of each kill and sell the grizzly DVD to the user. The site's developer, a Texan gun enthusiast, John Lockwood, 39, said it would give the frail, elderly, and disabled a chance to enjoy the thrill of the kill. This is about this is an opportunity to introduce people from the city who have no idea what hunting is all about. Okay, I don't know what hunting is all about, but I think that, you know, lining up with computer sensors through the internet to dust some, you know, thing in a pen, you know, that doesn't really seem to be what, you know, the great thrill of the hunt is for me. Maybe I'm totally wrong here. I don't know. I could be, you know, completely out of whack. More people are being chipped. Scottish nightclub is about to become the first in Britain to offer its customers the chance to have a microchip implanted in their arm to save them from carrying cash. How high do you got? Even the Irish, even the Scottish are not going to be drunk enough. I mean, if they offer it for free, they might do it. The digital wallet, the size of a grain of rice, guarantees entry to the club and allows customers to buy drinks on an account. Brad Stevens, owner of Bar Soda in Glasgow, said his customers have responded enthusiastically to the idea. Yeah, probably because he's giving away for free. The very chip inserted by a medical professional and then scanned for its unique ID number as customer enters the bar. There are a number of advantages, from instant access, not having to carry money or credit cards, to letting the bar's staff know a customer's name and favorite drink, said Mr. Steven. By the time you walk through the door to the bar, your favorite drink is waiting for you, and the bar staff can greet you by name. Dun, dun, dun. However, he said, the bar would also make sure the customers with the chip had a limit on how much they could spend to prevent their drinking beyond their ability to pay. You cannot have the fish, you can only have the chicken. The scheme was criticized by a spokesman for the Scottish executive who said the microchip could encourage excessive drinking, and by No Tags, a consumer group set up to register to resist the spread of radio frequency identification devices. No Tags. Be interesting to get some more information on them. So, I mean, you know, if you're going to affect people, you may as well affect, you know, the stupid people in your society who, you know, poison themselves as much as possible in the local, you know, tavern, which bars and taverns, really, let's be honest here, are nothing more than shooting galleries. They're the modern-day opium den. You go in there, everybody's, you know, getting drunk, everybody's trying to chase away the problems of the world. It's kind of sad. So, of course, you know, you don't have to bring money. Now you can be cool, because a lot of people who spend a lot of time at bars will do anything to make themselves feel better. That's why they're there. You have been bugged. Now, here, going with that story, here's one that'll really trip you out. You've been bugged. Electronic tagging could give petty criminals a chance to go straight, it was claimed today. Jim O'Keefe, Fine Gael Justice spokesman, said Big Brother monitoring system would deter first-time crooks from reoffending. Now, check this out. Electronic tagging could give petty criminals a chance to go straight, it was claimed today. This isn't the electronic tagging of hardened criminals. This could give petty criminals a chance to go straight by, you know, putting a GPS locator on you. Departments of Justice confirmed officials were drawing up plans based on a British high-tech tagging scheme to amend the Criminal Justice Act. Only in England, eh? You gotta love this stuff. Mr. O'Keefe said the following example of UK authorities tagging could be the best answer to a rising prison population and spiraling crime rates. Sending someone to prison, as particularly a first-time offender, is not always the best form of punishment, particularly if it encourages them to pursue crime as a career, Mr. O'Keefe said. Yeah, you want to take a your basic small-time criminal, turn him into a hardened criminal, put him in jail. Tagging also assists with rehabilitation and reintegration of offenders, allowing them to hold their jobs and stay in contact with their friends and families, all the while being scorned and ridiculed for being, you know, a criminal, and you've got the big mark of Cain on you there. It is understood senior officials at the Department of Justice discussed the use of tagging with the counterparts in the British Home Office. Mr. O'Keefe said the system would also prove to be a cost-effective way of punishing criminals. It is understood the scheme cost as little as £4,000 per offender. That's like $8,000 U.S., much less than imprisonment. So it's cost-effective, and, you know, it's better for the first-time offenders. You know, so you stole a car, now you get a GPS locator. No. For minor and first-time offenses, tagging relieves pressure on overcrowded prisons, and long-term, it can keep young people out of prison. No, what you've done is you made the world prison. That's what you've done. You've just taken the walls away from the prison. It also ensures that prison places are available for serious offenders, that they can also serve their full sentence, like file sharers and people who play video games, things like that, of course. You know, we want to make sure we can lock them up. It is understood as an amendment to the Criminal Justice Act provided for tagging could be in place by Easter. It is understood. There was a lot of things that were understood in this article. So let me get this straight. I'm going to, you know, do something relatively minor. Maybe I get drunk and punch out a cop or something like that. And because of this now, I get a GPS locator tag where I can be followed around. Does anybody else have a small problem with this? This is in England. Never mind the fact that they're all going to be getting, you know, the national ID tags and they'd licenses to watch television. I mean, how bad can it get, realistically? I mean, when you look at their situation over there, my God, I really feel bad for the English. You know, well, anyone in the UK. There's a lot of crap that those people have to put up with. Holy cow. It's just nuts. Now, here's a story that we should watch. The anthrax pardons. Now, this is something that I've always thought about. When I was in the Army, I got shot up with so many needles full of so much junk. And everybody who's been in the Army goes through the same thing. Now, when you're a soldier, you don't have the right to talk back. You get brainwashed into thinking that you're just some piece of meat. And they can do whatever they want to you. They can shoot you full of whatever they want. They can give you needles full of whatever. And you don't have the right to say a single word. Because if you do, you get totally chastised. Now, the fact that these Americans stood up and said, no, I don't want these needles. I mean, that's pretty impressive. And, you know, they got in a lot of crap because this anthrax vaccination that they were handing out, nobody's really sure if it worked or what it did. So there's a lot of fear going on. A lot of guys said, no, man, I'm not getting the needles. Kiss my ass. So U.S. Representative Christopher Shays is proposing amnesty for hundreds of military service members punished or chased from the military for refusing the controversial anthrax vaccine that a federal court judge has since deemed improperly licensed. Uh-oh. We need to make sure those who opted out of the vaccine program are not punished. Well, how about suing the people who were hit for the, they opted out. Yeah, it was your choice. Yeah, whatever. An unproven vaccine administered against an uncertain threat is simply not a good policy, and no punitive member should be taken against those who choose their health over fulfilling an ill-informed requirement. That's like the entire war, but never mind. Since the vaccinations began 6 years ago, nearly 500 active duty members have refused the vaccine, and more than 100 have been court-martialed, according to data filed in a federal court. 500 to 1,000 pilots and flight crew members have retired or transferred from the Air National Guard or reserves rather than take the vaccine. Government statistics of early 2004 show. There's a lot of people freaked out about that. And you can bet they didn't just get that from, you know, different websites. They must have got that from people they know or seen the effects of it. In 2002, the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported the vaccine's systematic adverse reaction was 100 times higher than the 0.2% rate reported on the product's label. Oh! So instead of seeing 0.2%, it was actually 20%. Adverse vaccine reactions, including immune disorders, muscle and joint pains, headaches, rashes, fatigue, nausea, diarrhea, chills, and fever. At least a half dozen deaths and a number of birth defects have been attributed to the use of the vaccine. Birth defects are just a scary, scary thing, any way you cut it. I mean, being a father has got to be, you know, just an amazing feeling. And then to realize that a choice you made to, you know, try to protect yourself has, you know, affected the life of this child that you brought into the world, and now the child has to live with the mistakes that you made. I mean, I don't think I'd want to live with something like that. After U.S. Secretary of Defense William Cohen mandated the vaccinations in 1998, eight veteran Connecticut Air National Guard combat pilots, almost a quarter of the 103rd Flight Wing resigned in protest. On average, a pilot with 9 years' experience costs the government $6 million to train, government research shows. So it was 9 times 6, that's like, what, $54 million they lost just for passing that law? But that gives me faith, though. It shows that, you know, hey, you'd think that the American Army would be the most, you know, intense, brainwashed place around. But it seems that, well, pilots are a little bit more switched on. They got to have, you know, the brain case has got to be working pretty good to be a pilot. You know, the ground pounders, the grunts, the legs, you know, God love them. Infantry, queen of the battlefield. But unfortunately, you know, they're not generally the sharpest knives in the drawer. So when you tell them to eat this or swallow this or kill this, they don't really ask a lot of questions. They just do it. That's why we love the infantry. Since that time, two of those pilots, Major Thomas Remfer and Russell Dingle, nice name Russell, now in Air Force Reserve, have become two of the leading challengers of the legality of the vaccine. Okay, so looking for a place in the history books. They have used their research to petition federal agencies to meet with officials at the Department of Defense and federal drug and health agencies to try to block forced use of the drug. Well, that's very noble, you know, because these guys are looking after the boys. So I'll have to commend that. And, yeah, I don't think they should be punished, because especially if they know. Now the Army's got a hell of a situation to deal with. Because they have to, you know, they got egg all over their face. Okay, it's a pretty nasty sandwich they're going to have to be dining on crow with here. I mean, this is, everyone said it was crap. They went ahead and did it anyway. And, you know, now they're going to have to pay for it. That's what happens when you don't, you know, go with science. You know, this is the kind of thing that occurs. And back in the good old USSA, yeah, you will be happy to learn that the former head of the KGB, that's the secret police of the former Soviet Union, General Yevgeny Primakov, nice name, has been hired as a consultant by the Department of Homeland Security of the United States of America. Do you think he will share an expertise in security, prepare U.S. citizens for domestic internal passports under the pretense of fighting the never-ending war on terrorism? Could be. I think it's scary that we're hiring the enemy's command to help us. I mean, it's tactically, I suppose it makes sense. CAPPS-2, CAPS-2, is the name of a new program which will technically under the auspices of the U.S. Department of Transportation, but that's only a technical, and the only reason why they did that was to use the Transportation Department budget to buy the computer hardware and software they need. The way it works is you give them a credit card, they slide it through like you would in a store, they hit a button, the monitor reads, CAPS-2, SSCTF. The SSCTF evidently stands for State Security Citizen Threat File, but has nothing to do with the Department of Transportation. It goes directly to a division which has been established between the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and the CIA, and several other federal agencies. This is, you know, the big database. And this is a new division referred to as the Office of Internal Security, which is coordinating the effort to establish a citizen threat file on every U.S. citizen. Now everyone's a threat. It will be a huge database, including credit files, medical files, political and religious affiliation, military history, attends anti-government rallies, etc. This has been talked about in some news clips. The only thing they'll tell you is that they're going to access your credit history, but like the guy doing the interview said, they'll be accusing them of a whole lot more. They just don't tell you what it is. When the Department of Homeland Security is asking about it, they replied it would defeat the purpose if they told you what they were looking for. So, we tell you what we're looking for, but we're just going to totally loom and be the security of Big Brother. This is such a, you know, really, the insanity boggles the mind. Now, here's something that nobody's talking about, and generally I could understand why no one's talking about it, because there's not much we can do about it, but I would still like to know. I'd still like to know what's happening. You've heard of global warming. Have you ever heard of global dimming? Well, apparently, check this out. We're all seeing rather less of the sun. Scientists looking at 5 decades of sunlight measurement have reached the disturbing conclusion that the amount of solar energy reaching the Earth's surface has been gradually fading. Paradoxically, the decline in sunlight also means the global warming is far greater threat to society than previously thought. I wonder if that has anything to do with what's going on with our crazy weather system right now. The effect was first spotted by Jerry Stanhill, an English scientist working in Israel. Comparing Israeli sunlight records from the 1950s with current ones, Stanhill was astonished to find a large fall in solar radiation. How much are we talking here? We're talking a staggering 22% in sunlight. 22%! Holy crap. Talk about the dark times. Intrigued, he searched out records from all over the world. He found the same story almost everywhere he looked. Sunlight falling by 10% all over the USA, nearly 30% in parts of the former Soviet Union, and 16% in the part of the British Isles. Now, Polushkin could be a part of that. Although the effect varied greatly from one place to the other, which I don't really understand, because it's a round ball or a certain set distance from the sun, what the hell. Overall, the decline amounted to 1 to 2% globally per decade between the 50s and the 90s. So 2% a decade, the sun's going out. Jerry called the phenomenon global dimming, but when his research was published in 2001, met with skeptical responses from other scientists. It was only recently, when his conclusions were confirmed by an Australian scientist using a completely different method to estimate solar radiation, that the climate scientists last woke up to the reality of global dimming. What a terrifying concept. I would hate to freeze to death because, you know, the sun goes out. But still, I'd like to, you know, at least be able to plan for that, you know, maybe have a few things in place, just a thought. Now, I remember WorldCom. WorldCom was a big evil company that, you know, sucked a whole bunch of people in and took a whole bunch of mom and dad's monies and stuff like that. That's what WorldCom was. So I'd like to, you know, really these corporations that, you know, they have these plunderers and these pirates and these real scumbags that are making billions and millions of dollars. And they're just maggots. And when we catch one of them, I really want to see one of these bastards hang. WorldCom Incorporated was in trouble. The stock price was wobbly, and Wall Street was asking tough questions. But CEO Bernard Edwards, a son of a bitch, repeated a positive message on the face of his company, promising sound finances, strong revenue growth, and conservative accounting. Famously reassuring concern analysis in 2001 that we do not see any storms on the horizon. Federal prosecutors say Edwards was lying, orchestrating a shell game to cover up his company's financial trouble and Wall Street's good graces. In the summer of 2002, WorldCom collapsed under the weight of an $11 billion accounting fraud and filed for the largest bankruptcy in the history of American business. Now, I didn't know it was that serious, but we never hear about this because we never get reported on business crime, but now you know. 2.5 years later, Ebers, 63, faces criminal fraud and conspiracy trial in New York, with jury selection getting underway this week, and I hope they hang him. The trial completes a remarkable arc for Edwards, from visionary who launched a long-distance company with colleagues from the Mississippi Coffee Shop in 83, to leader of one of the world's leading telecommunication firms, to accused felon, possibly facing years in prison. Wow. Sucks to be you. While Edwards has kept a low profile since he was indicted in March 2004, he has always maintained his innocence. Yeah, but don't they all? And that's all I got for you tonight, but don't worry, I'll be back tomorrow to make sure you get all the information you need to stay alive. This is a free broadcast brought to you by the generous donations of Jesse, Lars, Michael, Matt, Andrew, Kevin, Derek, Eric, Jason, Peter, Keith, Malcolm, Peter, Timor, Greg, Richard, WebLife, Drake, Matt, Evan, Brian, Ashton, David, Austin, Jonathan, Adam, William, Trevor, Jonathan, Mark, Katsuni, Art, Matthew, Christopher, Kyle, Justin, and Matthew. And if you would like to help keep this daily news broadcast on the air, please visit rantmedia.ca and click on donate. And I got a question the other day. Someone was asking me, they said, Sean, you know, you work during the day, right? Yeah, that's correct. I do a shift at this sweatshop warehouse from about 8 o'clock in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon. Then I come home and get my news facts together, answer a bunch of email, record the show. So I'm generally got this sucker wrapped up and in the can by about 10 o'clock at night. And then I rack out, you know, and try to eat somewhere in there too. And a lot of people are concerned about me burning out. And I'm sick right now, and that's why the show is short this week, okay? And I don't want you to worry about me, okay? I am okay. I get a lot of concerned email, people talking about me burning out and taking time for myself. And if I could take more time, I could. But if you want to help me, you know, not have to do this, we got to get the donations up so that I can dedicate full time. And when I do go full time, 3 months later, I'm going to put a book on the web for you guys. And I hate asking for money, but it's one of those kind of things that we've kind of got to do. You know, it's not dirty to make money. It's really not dirty to do that. And I've always had a problem with money. You know, I let my wife handle the whole thing. The Dark One owns or is my life. She's got root. Trust me on this one. But I think that what Sim says, and you know what Sim says goes, is that it's okay to make money provided you do it the right way. It's okay to make money provided you do it and you're not, you know, lying to people and you're not selling out. Which, you know, it could be argued up and down. I'm not here to argue it. I'm just trying to be as honest as I can with you, the listeners. I want to send a special thanks to Transix, Sylvanus, Jinjin Machina, Ricky Rocket, Pig Monkey, and Dog Nuts in Poland for their help today in setting up some facts and information for me. You know, Pig Monkey's actually, and Dog Nuts have both been sending in some really great stuff. And I'd like to get together with Pig Monkey, actually, have a beer with the guy, because he's pretty straight up. Well, no, not a beer, because I just, you know, I don't want to flip-flop anymore. Well, you know what I'm saying. Digital baptisms. Porsche agreed to have a digital baptism, and I've been saving this name for a while. And you can go figure out what this means on your own if you don't already know. But Porsche is now known as Matreus. Yeah, I've been waiting to drop that on. A good one. So Porsche, you are now Matreus. And for all of you out there who do have information or stories, please send them my way. You can send it an email to newsreel. That's newsreal at rantradio.com. And if you like the music in the background, be sure to pick up the album Praise the Fallen by VNV Nation. Really good, you know, dark industrial stuff. I'm going to leave you now with some longer bits, some spoken word stuff by Jello Biafra. And until tomorrow, that's what Server said. End of line.
Does anybody out there know that for the first time in American history, the U.S. Army was used in a war operation against the American people?
Yeah.
Right near here, up in Humboldt County, about 200 miles north of San Francisco, right near a town called Shelter Cove, get this, 300 to 400 American GIs dressed and fully armed with the automatic rifles, armed for battle, fanned out on maneuvers through the woods, backed up by a dozen Black Hawk attack helicopters. The mountain people up there were frightened out of their wits. They thought there was a war going on, especially the ones who had soldiers kicking in the doors to their cabins and putting guns to their heads in front of their children. Why? Who was the enemy in this war? Not the communists, not Saddam Hussein, not Earth First or even the Spotted Owl. No. The enemy. They called out the army to put down secretly so as few people outside of Humboldt would get alarmed as possible. It wasn't even a person or an army or a terrorist group. It was a plant. The marijuana plant. And they actually did find a few for the GIs to pull up, and then they had to fly in more from the government stash so the pile would look big enough when they lit the bonfire for the network TV news cameras so they could say, yes, another triumph in the drug war. Drug war. War. The American army sent to war against the American people. And we're supposed to feel relieved and secure and protected. Protected from what? A lot of people with more guts than I'll ever have risked their life and limb all last summer at the Earth First Redwood Summer Action up in Humboldt County. They were chaining themselves to redwoods that were three times wider than they were spread-eagled. They were 800 years old as the saws buzzed right over their heads. They stood in the dirt as the bulldozers charged them and stopped right at their toes. Or people waved clubs at them, charged them with logging trucks, shotguns, you name it. All to try and save some of the last unspoiled virgin forest we have left anywhere in this country from being chopped down and made into toilet paper, TV guides, and the Weekly World News. On the other side, the loggers saying, what about our jobs? What about our families? What about our lives? You needed wood and cardboard to make those protest signs. We need fuel. We need paper. It's almost gone. Where are we going to get more? The answer for centuries has been right under our nose. Grow more pot. If we're serious about saving the earth, saving the ozone, and our freedom to go about saving the earth and the ozone, we should start by paying all those dirt poor coca farmers in South America and out of work loggers in Fortuna and Eureka and Midwest family farmers and Rust Belt families too, to all get together and grow more pot. Why? Get ready for this. There's a book out. It's called The Emperor Wears No Clothes. The author's name is Jack Harar. It's published by Queen of Clubs. I think there's ads for it in High Times or Normal, National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws. They could direct you to one, I'm sure. And in this book, among other places, it is written, before the 20th century, the marijuana plant provided almost all the world's paper, all the world's clothing and textiles, and almost all the world's rope. According to none other than the U.S. Department of Agriculture, you can make four times as much paper from an acre of marijuana hemp plants as you can from an acre of trees. And instead of chopping down all the redwoods in Humboldt County and turning Northern California and Oregon and Washington into Appalachia or the Sahara Desert, if you do it with hemp plants, you can just grow another crop a few months later and make more paper. At one quarter the cost of making paper from wood pulp and only one fifth the pollution. The ancient Romans knew this and grew it. Henry VIII made each farmer in Old England grow their share, because they knew if you want the strongest natural fiber there is, you all got to do your part for the king and grow more pot. And we did, too. Guess what Levi jeans were originally made out of? And guess what American flags used to be made out of? And guess what the early drafts of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were written on? And if that's too unchristian for you, guess what they made Gutenberg and King James Bibles out of? Guess what you can use to power a car? Can get at least four times as much cellulose to make gasohol or methanol from hemp stems as he can from a corn stalk, which along with solar energy would be a great way to avoid dying for oil in Saudi Arabia. In the 20s and 30s, most American cars and farm machinery had the option of running on gas or on methanol. Most racing cars still do run on methanol. And George Washington and Thomas Jefferson grew cannabis on their plantations and smoked it, too. In the 1760s in the American colonies, you could even be jailed for not growing pot, because that was part of the key to become economically independent from Britain. Hemp was legal tender in America, a substitute for money, from 1630 clear up until the early 1800s. And hemp seeds are a great source of protein, better than soybeans, and it's cheaper than soybeans, too. Or so says the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Marijuana is legal for medical use in 34 states. Used to treat glaucoma and pain caused by cancer, you can digest more protein out of a hemp seed than a soybean seed. It's even shown some signs of being able to combat herpes. And guess what kind of a parachute Mr. Drug War Junta Man himself, George Bush, used when he bailed out of that bomber in World War II? Hemp was illegal by then, but farmers were briefly ordered to grow it again in this country for the war effort and all, and the U.S. Army had their own stash all along in the colonies in the Philippines. So, how did everything get turned around so damn bad? Doesn't it strike you as a little dumb that we burn oil and choke ourselves and chop down all our trees and ruin innocent people's lives by branding them criminals and throwing them in jails or sending them off to drug camps or taking all their property and selling it before they're brought to trial, in the process making crack and heroin cheaper and easier to get than pot? Why do we do this when we don't have to? Meanwhile, the police chief of L.A., Daryl Gates, gets front page approval for telling a U.S. Senate committee that pot smokers should be shot on sight. Because smoking pot is treason, because after all, it's illegal. Why was marijuana cracked down on? And why was it done so violently? Well, ready? In 1936, Popular Mechanics magazine hailed the invention of a new machine to process hemp, predicting that marijuana hemp would once again become the world's largest cash crop. This did not sit at all well with people like Hearst Paper Manufacturing, or Kimberly-Clark, or other cutthroat multinationals who happened to have large timber holdings. Didn't sit too well with tobacco barons, for obvious reasons. And it sure as hell didn't sit too well with our old buddies DuPont. Hemp processing uses only one-fifth the chemicals needed to process wood pulp, and DuPont had just patented a new wood pulp sulfide process. And DuPont's patented plastic fibers had just passed up hemp as the number two fiber next to cotton, and they wanted to keep it that way. And the last thing the big drug companies wanted was to lose their share of the ever-lucrative disease industry market to more affordable medicine made from marijuana or other natural ingredients because, check this out, you can't own and make money off a patent for medicine in this country unless the medicine has chemicals in it. If it's all natural ingredients, you can't patent it. Maybe that's why we don't have access to a cure for cancer or AIDS, or why the health food store I go to keeps getting harassed by federal authorities for selling herbal medicines. Meanwhile, guess who owns Congress? So, marijuana was outlawed in 1937. And they fanned the racism fires, playing the racism card just like they do when they want to crack down on rock and roll or rap or hip-hop or something like that. They said that smoking marijuana might cause you to fall under the influence of listening to jazz. And I believe it was even said on the floor of Congress that marijuana had to be banned because smoking it might make a black man look at a white woman twice. And let's not forget that U.S. Treasury Department-funded documentary film called Reefer Madness. So marijuana was outlawed as devil weed in 1937. Only 53 years ago, it was legal. Need I say more on why our beloved fearless leaders go out of their way to censor our access to information so damn much? Can you imagine the mass outrage if this kind of stuff ever really got out? And people knew that this so big drug problem they keep reading about and hearing about is being caused by the government themselves? And people knew how easily each one of us individually could turn our ecological and human crisis around without resorting to Nazi bullshit like oil wars and drug wars just by saying no to George Bush? Yeah. And people knew that the very companies that provide us with such crucial conveniences as Kleenex, paper towels, and junk mail have systematically and brutally rearranged every single one of our lives so that we are literally wiping our ass with our own future. And it doesn't have to be this way. I mean, I'll tell you, I do feel kind of funny saying all this because I used to be a pothead and I hate smoking the stuff and the whole low-energy stoner deadhead vibe that comes with it. But you don't need to smoke pot to realize that the real drug problem in this country is not the drugs. And we can help solve our drug problems, crime problems, environmental problems, even our racial problems, if we say no to George Bush and get together and grow more pot. Yes.
Hello, is there anybody? basic facts. Can you show me where it hurts? There is no pain you are receiving. A distant ship's moaning.